So you have these two triangles at play, the upward and the downward, and Mercury is the one, the binding agent of this three masculine and the three feminine. You need one, the communicator. And this is why Mercury rules connection. Because without Mercury, without communication, how can a yin-yang have a conversation? How can masculine and feminine have a conversation?
Welcome to the Cosmic Keys podcast. This is going to be your episode for July 22nd to the 28th, 2019. So we are almost towards the end of July. It's flying by. I don't know about you, Dan, but I feel like this summer is flying by.
Most definitely.
And we had the Fool card last week. So how did that go for you?
Well, it's funny because I had an absolute Fool card week out of the blue. During the eclipse, I made the decision to do a water fast, which is really foolish of me, just like jumping into it. Basically, the backstory is I have pretty bad, what it's called, silent reflux. So it's like acid reflux that makes it hard to breathe. And it's gotten worse. It's partially because I'm a vocalist and you have to like kind of clench your abdomen when you sing, and it like puts pressure on your stomach. So long story short, I was doing a lot of research last week on ways to fix it, and water fasting was one of them. And water fasting is basically where you don't eat anything, you just drink water for an extended amount of time.
I think it would have only lasted like 5 hours.
You know, I'm kind of down for like the extreme health stuff once in a while. I do have the North Node in the sixth house. But yeah, it was kind of masochistic of me. But basically, you just lie around and don't do a lot of activity. And I did it for 3 days. Now I'm breaking the fast by eating like bone broth to sort of reline the gut. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to bore people with my suffering, but It was an experience for sure. Definitely a test of my will, and definitely Fool card like in the way that I just did it spontaneously.
Just jump right in.
Like when we recorded last week, I had no plans to do this, and then I actually pulled some cards. Like, should I do this? Should I do this? And I kept getting good cards, so that's kind of what compelled me to do it actually. So hopefully, I gave my body a nice reset, which was appropriate for the eclipses where you want to be like laying low. And since it was a South Node eclipse, it's actually really good for like detoxing. So I kind of killed two birds with one stone with that. But how about you? Did you have any Fool stuff yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I've been like jumping into a lot of reading on different topics lately. So that's kind of been fun, spending a lot of time doing that. And expanding my knowledge in kind of a lot of other areas of the esoteric arts that I haven't been as familiar with. So that's kind of been like a little Fool card moment, jumping into that, trying to expand my education. But yeah, you know, I didn't lay low for the eclipse season. I've been kind of bouncing around, going all over the place. I went to a full moon jam, which is an event here in Chicago that happens on the full moon. It's basically where pretty much all the hippies congregate into one area.
It's kind of Burning Man-esque.
Yeah, and there's like a drum circle, there's fire dancers, people come and picnic and drink wine. So, yeah, you know, it was fun, but I am feeling a bit of that kind of like chaotic energy. I probably should have been laying a bit low, because I'm definitely feeling like overwhelmed, like there's so much going on right now. So I probably should take the advice of astrology and, you know, tone it down a bit for next week. Yeah,
I mean, we're past the eclipse at this point, but we are like, the moon is gonna be waning until the new moon at the end of the month, and the new moon is gonna be a fresh new start with Mercury going direct. So
yeah, we're definitely still in Mercury retrograde, so I've been experiencing like tech problems like all over the place,
like broken headphones today.
Oh yeah, definitely, it just keeps on popping up. So I'm excited to see what card we get for the next week coming up ahead. Hopefully it'll take us into a good spot. I really liked getting the Fool. I think it's always fun when he shows up. And it kind of follows our tradition. We've been getting so many majors lately, punctuated with a few minors here and there, but definitely that's been kind of the wider trend that we've been experiencing.
Yeah, I totally felt the Fool just because, you know, I started the water fast. It's easy. You just don't eat. You stop eating.
And for then, you, that might be easy. For me, that would be really hard.
It wasn't easy, but I mean, it wasn't like I had to go buy a bunch of stuff or like prepare. It's just like you cut yourself off and then you suffer. But the whole way through, I was like educating myself on the go. Like I watched the videos while starving myself. It was just crazy. It was literally like a Sunday evening. I was like, shit, should I do this? Should I do it? Pulled a few cards. I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. And then it was like totally the dive off the cliff at that point. So,
yeah. Well, are you ready to see where we end up next week?
Let's see.
Okay. Ooh, we're going dark, guys. It's dark time. We got the Nine of Swords, guys. And this one, visually, it's really intense. It shows a person up at night with their head in their hands. Along the wall are the nine swords kind of stacked up there. And on the bed that she's in, there's this tiny carving scene of like a battle, like someone stabbing someone with one of the swords. So this is a card that can reflect extreme anxiety, feeling overwhelmed to the point where literally you're having nightmares, you can't sleep at night because your anxiety is kind of taking over your life. And this is kind of interesting because I was just talking about earlier how I feel like I've just been doing too much at once lately. And if this card is what we have coming on next week, then that's definitely a sign, you know, that I really need to slow down the amount of projects I'm taking on all at once. Because it's just going to, you know, spiral me into an anxious cycle. So that's really, you know, what you want to think about is what can you do to slow down? How can you control your anxiety, whether that's through yoga or meditation or cutting down the amount of tasks you need to complete next week so things are a bit more chill? Yeah, I mean, this is dark. We haven't gotten a card this bad for a while.
I mean, it's about time.
You think?
It's crazy, too. I think on Instagram today, I saw the tarot lady pulled that card.
Really?
And I was like, I hope that doesn't apply to me. And then here we go. We pulled
Boom.
It.
Boom.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the most obvious negative card. I mean, most of the swords I see is kind of negative, but...
Well, when you hit the 8, it's just downhill. Like, the 8, the 9, and the 10. It just keeps on getting darker. And this one especially, the 9. Be aware, be conscious of your anxiety this week, because it's potentially going to peak. So be prepared for that.
I mean, I feel pretty cynical. Like, this has been a really rough month, astrologically. So now that we get this, I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Like you're used to it.
I'm like, yeah, that's the default mode anyways. So it's like, hey, nothing new. But
well, let's see. How does this fit into what we have going on astrology-wise next week?
So astrology-wise next week, or this week if you're listening, we start off on July 22nd with the sun entering Leo.
Well, that's good, right?
Yeah, it is good. I mean, Cancer, you can consider the meat grinder zone. Cancer is where the eclipses happened. Cancer is where, you know, it's opposite of Pluto, Saturn, and the South Node. The North Node is there. And every time planets pass through that area of Cancer, they get hit with that opposition. So it's like, if you think of the planets moving through the zodiac on a journey, every time they have to go through Cancer or Capricorn, for that matter, they're getting hit by these difficult aspects. So we're moving out of a cardinal sign, out of that meat grinder zone, into a fixed sign. Leo is fixed fire. So it's all about like holding the fire within in a fixed way. And it's really associated with passion and enthusiasm and gusto. So... I mean, I'm a Leo.
You have bias.
Yeah. I mean, As far as the time of the year, though, you think of it, it's like the time when the sun is really hot. So most Leos are born sort of at peak summer, and they're used to like the heat and the fire and the passion. So it's, and Leo also rules the heart, so it's very heart centered. Leos have wonderful, beautiful hearts. Like
are you talking about yourself right now, or?
Well, in relation to myself, I'm very heavy Leo and very heavy Scorpio, and those two are just like so at odds. They form a square in the zodiac. So it's funny, on this show, I think my Leo really gets to shine, and I am embracing my Leo. But mm-hmm. You kind of know I have like a very cynical, very dark, very spooky side that's sort of self-loathing in many ways too. So I'm not like an egomaniac, you know, total Leo. I'm a Leo with like a very scorpionic side, because I have the moon ascendant and Pluto all right next to each other in Scorpio. But when the sun moves into Leo, it's a great time to sort of embrace the performer within yourself. It's a great time to let your ego or your true self shine. So, and it's just basically a good thing to be getting out of the Cancer zone. I mean, I love Cancer too, but Cancer this summer has been rough, as we know. So, yeah, like we said last week, we had the lunar eclipse in Capricorn opposite Cancer. And so now the moon is going to be moving towards the new moon. So it's going to be waning, decreasing in light as we move through the week. So this week into next week is all about wrapping things up as we get closer to the end of July. So then moving along, on Wednesday, July 24th, Mercury in Cancer is going to be conjunct Venus in Cancer. So Mercury moved retrograde backwards into Cancer last Friday. And it's getting closer to the point where it's going to go direct. I believe it's going direct around 24 degrees Cancer. So when Mercury retrogrades into a conjunction with Venus, as Venus is moving towards the end of Cancer, this is a chance for you to use the Mercury retrograde themes to re-examine the way you think about your relationships. So it's very analytical. It's reviewing your relationships, I would say. And it's in a mental space in a water sign. So it's going to have an emotional component to it. I feel like on this day, on Wednesday, you could have a lot of emotional breakthroughs in relation to your relationships. So pay attention to that happening on Wednesday, the 24th. Thursday, the 25th, action planet Mars, which is in Leo right now, is going to make a trine to Jupiter in Sagittarius. So Mars being your action, your willpower, your ambition, and your drive to do, to act, is flowing harmoniously with Jupiter, which is your expansive optimism and your... it's related to spirituality. It's related to just growth and abundance. So this could be a great day to do a lot of gym activity. Lots of physical activity would be great for Mars. It could have a sexual component because Mars is a sexual planet. So I think in general, Mars and Jupiter trining both in fire signs is a good thing. So try to do something really productive on Thursday, because you're going to have that energy and you're going to have the ambition to just get shit done. So pay attention to that on Thursday. I mean, so far, I'm not seeing a lot of Nine of Swords astrology. Yeah. But anyways, maybe we'll keep
looking. Maybe that kind of like physical activity can help alleviate anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, preventing that Nine of Swords concept.
This is technically the last difficult week. We're still sort of not out of the woods because we haven't finished eclipse season. So maybe, the Nine of Swords might just be sort of the hangover from July, which, you know, I had a very difficult month. expected. I expected to have a difficult month based on the astrology. So maybe if you feel the Nine of Swords popping up, try to just embrace these good aspects like we get on Thursday.
Yeah.
Moving along, on Saturday, Venus is going to be leaving Cancer, again, leaving that meat grinder zone and entering Leo. So it's kind of meeting up with the Sun, moving towards the Sun. That happens at 9:54 p.m. Eastern on Saturday night.
So passion.
Yeah, I have natal Venus in Leo myself, too. And when Venus enters Leo, it definitely has like a creative... It inspires creativity and performance for sure, because Leo is the performer, the actor, the person who loves to be on stage, and Venus has a component to her which is very artistic also. So it in terms of your relationships and stuff, it's going to make you, I mean, it's going to help your heart, because Leo rules the heart. It's going to give you the fixed fire passion that Leo is so well known for, and it's gonna like make you want to be more creative or artistic and be seen. So maybe the shadow of this aspect could be like too much ego or too much self-centeredness and too much charisma. Venus in fire signs is a little tricky. She's more of, you know, she rules Taurus and Libra and is exalted in Pisces. So fire signs are a little more tricky, but overall Venus and Libra, I think will be a nice change now that we're moving out of the Cancer meat grinder zone. And basically, you know, throughout the week, the moon the moon is going to be waning throughout the week. It's going to be in Aries at the start of the week, entering Taurus midweek. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, anytime the moon is in Taurus, that's kind of a treat. And then Saturday into Sunday, moon will be in Gemini. And then, you know, next Wednesday on the 31st is the day that the moon finally enters Leo in the morning, and then Mercury goes direct later that night. So
I feel like we should celebrate and have a party on that day.
Well, my birthday is 2 days later.
Oh, awesome.
So maybe I will be. But so, yeah, I think on the surface, I don't see a lot of Nine of Swords. So maybe that will help alleviate the Nine of Swords stuff that pops up. And I think
it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
I mean, when I saw the Nine of Swords, like I said, I'm like, yep. That's been me the whole month, unfortunately.
it's more like a general theme to eclipse season as opposed to like what's going to be happening on a day-to-day sense for next week, maybe.
And if it does pop up, which usually these things do pop up when we draw the cards, inevitably, if the Nine of Swords does pop up, know that you have the stars on your side. I would say maybe embrace the Leo. Embrace pride and confidence and charisma and your heart. Like, don't let the mental anxiety of a Swords card like break you. Try to embrace that fire, because like we said, Thursday is a great day for fiery Mars Jupiter interaction. Sun is entering a fire sign, Venus is entering a fire sign, and the moon will be in Taurus for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So we shall see. I'd say keep your chin up and don't turn into that character on the Nine of Swords. Like, oh, why me? Why me? Which I've been doing all month.
Yeah, you gotta stay optimistic about it for sure. So yeah, that's going to be our forecast for this week. So definitely stay tuned. We have a really wonderful interview coming up with Nisa of the VNS Mystery School. So she is a fellow astrologer, so stay tuned for that. So today on the Cosmic Keys, we have Nisa Liu, and she is a astrologer, and she also has her own mystery school, the VNS Mystery School. So Nisa, we are so excited to talk to you today. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Hello from San Francisco. I'm so happy to be here chatting with you guys.
Wonderful. Yeah, we're happy to be talking with you too. So Nisa, we usually start off by talking to our guests about their origins, whether or not they were raised with a particular religion or what their childhood was like in relation to their entryway into spirituality. So what was your childhood like, and were you raised with any particular religion yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, I have Sagittarius in my fourth house, so can you imagine? So all the things. So I was born and raised in Jakarta, Indonesia, which for the longest stretch of history was the biggest Hindu kingdom. And the past few hundred years, it has become the largest Muslim nation. However, within my family, I was, in a way, raised by Chinese grandparents who were Taoist and also, you know, pretty much lived the lifestyle that is the Confucius, which is the very Eastern view perspective of cosmology, basically, and how they live life. And then along the way, my family became born again Christian. So I grew up with that. And then I left home early. I moved to Europe. So by the time I was like 15, and then by the time I was 16, I was already in San Francisco. So there's like a stretch of time there where it was very transient, you know, stay in Europe. And then when I got to San Francisco, you know, Berkeley's like right there. And I met a group of friends who were very diverse. And then I just sort of entertained the whole, a lot of religions, actually. I became highly interested in different, you know, mystical characters or not, like Lao Tzu, the teaching of Buddha, and then I was trying to reconnect with my Chinese root because I felt like I was kind of like a banana, you know, like yellow on the outside and white on the inside. And I wanted to be Chinese, or that was during my Saturn return as well. So really trying to grasp that root. And then after part of getting, you know, in touch with my root was actually the study of feng shui. You know, and that was kind of my start in divination, if you may. And then the path of feng shui then pretty much led me to astrology, but also interweaving, because for half a decade I was actually a wine sommelier as well.
Ooh, that sounds like a fun job.
Yeah, absolutely. Get paid to drink. so fun. But when I was studying wine, and it was so interweaved too, what people don't realize about wine, it is an agricultural product. So when I was deep in my study, I would also observe the cycle of time in nature. And then pretty much my study of wine introduced me to the philosophy of like Rudolf Steiner, and then Michio Kushi with macrobiotic. And of course, then astrology is just a natural progression. So that was kind of like the influence that I have, that kind of got me here.
That's really interesting. When you were describing like the background of religious culture in Indonesia, the way that it's, you know, it sounds like you were kind of surrounded by Islam, but had a Chinese origin and background by your grandparents. But then your right. parents, you said, were born again Christian. I'm wondering, like, what did you believe back then when you were sort of surrounded by all this? Or what was your perspective at a young age?
Well, in so many ways, you know, I went to Catholic school too, in addition, but it was a very good school where most of the kids are all the five major religions in Indonesia in that school. And those are the Muslims, and then the Catholic, the Christian, and then the Buddhist, as well as the Hindu. So pretty much until I was in seventh grade, I get to study this, well, also experience these five religions in my daily life. You know, for example, Ramadan, I would fast too because there's just no food around. You know, it's rude if you have food around during Ramadan. And then also because Muslim, they don't eat pork. So I actually never had pork product, even though I was not Muslim. I never touched pork product until I was 19 in the United States, and that was bacon.
That's a good pork product to start with.
I know. It was definitely the gateway drug to pork products, and I never looked back since, you know. So, yeah.
And on top of that, not only did you have this surroundings of all these kind of different cultures and religions, I mean, then you kind of go to Europe and it's like a whole nother new group of religions and cultures too. What was that transition like?
Well, my mother back in the day, she had a fashion business. So that's the connection between how I traveled to Europe quite a bit. I would travel with her. I was her child labor. you know, she's a big believer in training by experience. So I actually lived in Paris because I have to work after school for my mother. So it was not like a glamorous thing. Well, it's still pretty, you know, privileged in so many ways. But the most fantastic thing, of course, Paris is just like a living museum, you know, everywhere you see, you have the classical mythology, symbolism, and art at every corner. And I got area where it's just two blocks away from the Louvre, which is the big museum where the Mona Lisa, you know, is at. So, and also the most interesting thing when I moved to Paris, you know, my French was very little, but then I had to, you know, accelerate pretty quickly since I lived there. And I actually learned English when I was in international school in Europe. You know, so I just always feel it's definitely, you know, fourth house Sagittarius, you know, in manifestations.
Yeah, I remember visiting like the Louvre for the first time when I was in Paris, and it's amazingly wonderful to see all of these artworks and statuary that have these kind of deep symbolic component to it. A lot of interesting esoteric art at the Louvre.
Oh, totally.
And then on top of that, you know, because Napoleon basically stole everything from Egypt, there's this huge Egyptian collection in France. Mm-hmm. So if you're into, you know, the occult or the esoteric arts, I mean, and you have the chance to go to the Louvre, it's just so wonderful to see all of the variety of art there and all this kind of fascinating history and symbolism that connects back to things like astrology, the other esoteric arts.
Yeah, it's for me, it's always such a full circle, you know? I mean, I didn't plan on growing up to be a professional astrologer. It's, you know, it's not like a line of work that was advertised in elementary school, you know? However, along the way of my journey of life, it all path points to this door, you know? And then so because of that European influence, when I moved to San Francisco, I actually went to art school because I want to have more exposure with art and beautiful things. And at art school at the Academy of Art University, within pretty much the first semester, I took a class which is Joseph Campbell, Power, Myth, and Symbols. And so that was pretty much ingrained in me so early. And I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Joseph Campbell, which mm-hmm. is the, you know, Power, Myth, and Symbol. And the heroes with the thousand faces. And just the whole idea of archetypes. And then so I started to see things through that lens early on during that education. And then I studied art history. I also studied cinema. I studied photography. Everything that an art school would offer, at least I would take the history and the 101.
Yeah, it's fascinating with Campbell. And once you start kind of learning about the archetypes, you realize how that's really like the base of all of these other studies, like astrology
Absolutely.
And tarot. It all connects back to that. So that's mm-hmm. like a perfect entryway to kind of get interested in this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was like similar. Like I studied English literature in college, and after college, I was really trying to write fiction. And I just remember like studying Joseph Campbell like in such an anal way. Like I would literally like underline stuff and like rewrite it in a notebook just to like imprint it into my brain. And
right.
It's interesting too. There's so many authors out there that sort of like made Campbell more easy to digest. Like I remember there's this book out there. I think it's called like The Writer's Journey. And it basically Ooh. Goes through a whole formula on how to like craft fiction by using those principles of Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. And anybody that has like the least bit of interest in Campbell probably is susceptible to being interested in astrology too, because it's
absolutely yeah. it's so interconnected. Mm-hmm. And I have to also credit the work of Carolyn Mace. I don't know if you're familiar with her work.
I'm not. Could you tell us more about her?
So I found her. You know, I'm an Oprah's girl, so I watch Oprah, and I found Carolyn Mace there. And also, for a long time, I was actually working with a psychotherapist who is under this, you know, pretty much part of CIIS, which is California Integral Institute Studies. I don't know if you're familiar with that school in San Francisco. Fabulous school. I mean, I'm never a student, but just the proximity of it. Richard Tarnas, who wrote Cosmos and Psyches, and mm-hmm. So he's a faculty at CIIS. And then so my therapist was then, you know, also knew my huge astrology interest, because I would spat out, you know, aspects during the session, you know. And she would introduce me to all these names. And like Carolyn Mace was something that she would mention too, because, you know, I was on the other side of the chair once upon a time in therapy. And I found that learning the archetype was such a rope to for me to learn my own personal healing journey, because with archetypes I'm able to put a language, and therefore it grants access for me to work with myself easier. I don't know. I guess that's kind of a little bit of my philosophy, that I really see astrology as a spiritual path, as a language of like reality. It always shows honesty, even though I want to tell myself otherwise. It's like right there, So how is it with you guys? Can you see, part of what you do in astrology as well tarot as a spiritual path, as more than a skill?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Tarot, for me, in kind of my daily tarot practice, is kind of the base of my spiritual journey, because it can connect to so many other facets. It's really, been really wonderful as a tool to kind of guide my life, but also beyond just being a tool, as a wider framework for understanding the universe, understanding philosophy, symbolism, religion, kind of everything
right.
Can tie back into tarot and through those archetypes. And I'm not sure about you, Dan, but I feel like it's kind of similar for astrology as well.
Yeah, astrology, learning your own birth chart is like really deep work. And
oh, it is.
It's it's like you can't, you have to sort of take it as it is and realize, it gives you a perspective on yourself that maybe you wouldn't have always considered. Like, we all have our perceptions of the way other people perceive us, but that's really biased. And reading the birth chart is really objective as opposed to subjective. And I think it helps you be more compassionate to other people too, because
for sure.
Like, even with me, it's Mercury retrograde, so I've been, every Mercury retrograde, I like reread my journals. Yeah. And over and over again, I was like journaling about certain people that had, say, a very materialistic point of view. And now that I study astrology, that's just the way they are. They're living their truth by being, say, very Capricorn, or
absolutely.
And I don't have any earth in my chart, and I'm like I'm like way too much fire and water and no air and no earth. So like I sort of like would always be like, oh, they're like too obsessed with status, or they're too obsessed with earning a successful career. They don't have a heart. They don't have passion. But now that I've been studying astrology for so long, I'm like, actually, that's just the way a lot of people are. I happen to not be that way. That doesn't make them wrong. So, and even people, even like, sort of people that have like negative, pessimistic outlooks, that could be reflected in the chart. It's not necessarily their fault. And when you have that perspective that the chart is your roadmap and it's sort of what you're stuck with, it gives you compassion. Like, some people have gnarly charts and it's like, it's not their fault.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, first, I feel astrology is such a great tool for a candid self-exploration. And second of all, it is kind of, voyeuristic in so many ways, because you can read someone's chart and you can assign meanings but with your studies and everything else. And then you can imagine their perspective, are there more watery, are we dealing with a Neptunian over here or are we dealing with Saturn? And that for me, it's it's a really great tool even just to manage yourself, manage your expectations, manage your communications, because I just think it's a holistic language. So you can use it in so many ways. You know, why wouldn't you want to know the language of the universe, right? And everything is universal anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So for astrology, when in your story, in your life, did it start to kind of take a big influence? I know you said you were a sommelier for a while. Did you start getting involved in astrology after that? Or when did you start to fall down this path?
Let's see. Well, my mother, I lost my mom when I was 26 to cancer. And I think that was definitely a transformative time for me. I was looking for answers. Mm-hmm. And so I did not seek out astrology in the beginning. I was studying things more like Deepak Chopra at the time, Wayne Dyer, you know. But then somehow I found Alan Watts. And that's also a huge influence. I don't know if you're familiar with the name. He basically taught a lot about time and space and existence, consciousness. And I needed to explain things to myself that has never been explained before in any religions, you know. I wanted to know answers to, like, you know, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here? You know? So yeah, I have stellium in Virgo. So the way I solve that problem is to, you know, study everything, and kind of look at everything as a kaleidoscope and then see what reflects back to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So what were some of the things that you were initially looking into? I know you were mentioning a couple authors there, but I think earlier you said that you also studied like feng shui at this time. Is that correct?
Yes. So I studied feng shui here in the Bay Area from the Golden Gate School of Feng Shui. And there's a very interesting faculty, and his name was Liu Ming. So that's also my last name in Chinese, my maiden name, last name in Chinese. So I'm like, oh, you know, kismet. And I studied his material until he passed away. And he taught feng shui, and but he also is a huge believer on not making a separation between feng shui and astrology. And so that was a very interesting take. And at that time, my segue into astrology was Chinese astrology. So I would study what we would call the Tongshu, which is the Chinese lunar almanac. And back in the day, this actually is just something that the Chinese people, you know, which is a huge population of our earthly plane, would go by. You know, it's not until the 1960s that they follow the same calendar that we do now. So for the longest time, they have been following their Tongshu and their almanac, which has a synchronicity to the agricultural calendar. So my segue into astrology is what we know as mundane astrology, which is the bigger perspective, because the way the Chinese look at astrology, it's for the collective always, you know. And also, you know, in Chinese, they have a lineage of court astrologers and feng shui, and they were large. They're actually large body. They're almost the size of the military, calculating and looking at the sky and making decisions, making court decisions, basically, back in the day.
One of the things that I found really interesting when you were talking about feng shui is that it kind of has the ability to answer some questions like, are you even physically located in the right country or in the right place? And I guess I never thought of like a system being able to determine something like that. Have you done it for yourself? Like, is San Francisco like a place that you're meant to be from a feng shui perspective?
Absolutely. So from the feng shui perspective, you know, there's actually different spots in the world that has feng shui, you know, this beautiful lay of the land where it's has the dragon, the tiger, the turtle, you know, all these symbolism. And usually that kind of symbolize a lot of portal city. So San Francisco has all, you know, what they call the armchair placement. So these are cities like Sydney, Hong Kong, Cape Town, and San Francisco is one of them too, and they're portal city. And places like this, the portal cities, I have always believed the portal places, they chose their own cast of characters, you know, in so many ways. You think that only human has free will, but the place is a spirit as well, and it can cast the characters that, you know, the place wants to play out. And I believe between San Francisco and Berkeley, there's definitely a huge influence of, you know, a pull of an energy, you know, for people that is very Aquarian, that is into progress. So in terms of feng shui, a lot of my fate would not have been open. Like, I would never be an astrologer had I lived anywhere else. Well, I wouldn't know that. But my chart's pretty strong there. So I think, like, everywhere I would go, it would find me in some way. But, you know, it's a great place for me to be with all the interests that I have.
Yeah, San Francisco is such a interesting and unique city. I think there's like a great quote. I think it's by Tennessee Williams, who said there's only three American cities: New York, New Orleans, and San Francisco. Everywhere else is Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I think that's the quote. And I like that quote because those three cities, you know, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans are probably the most distinctive of the American cities. They each have, like you said, kind of their own spirit, their own identity to them. Mm-hmm. Though it's interesting with San Francisco because it's in the news so much, you know, because of the housing crisis. So you have this like tough intersection of, you know, the city being this hotbed of Aquarian souls, you might say, like very countercultural, you know, the hippie movement, very open-minded. But then at the same time with Silicon Valley and the tech kind of pushing people out, you know, are you worried about kind of the spirit of the city and where it's headed?
Well, I feel like the place itself is allowed to have progressions, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I've lived in San Francisco longer than I've lived anywhere else in my life. It, you know, I know it like the back of my hand, and I consider it home before anywhere else, even the place that I was born. Am I worried for the city? No, I think the city wants to feel what it wants to feel, and it manifested the way it's manifesting. And I'm so lucky and privileged to be here. And also, you know, bear witness and be a part of the metamorphosis that's happening.
Yeah, San Francisco is one, like when I visited it, I was like, I should live here. I could totally see myself living here. Because I went to school in Colorado and in Boulder and had some friends that were from the Bay Area. And whenever I would visit up there, the spirit of place up there really is like one of a kind. I mean, you don't get redwood trees, forests near a misty, rocky Pacific Ocean bay. It's like a mix. It's kind of a mixture of like the Rocky Mountain style with like rugged terrain, but it's also got the ocean right there too.
Yeah, it's like the land of the Guanyin, you know, the bounty, the abundance. I mean, the produce that we have here, the sunshine, the temperate climate, again, the proximity to nature, as it is also a very metropolitan city. So it has these ranges for a compact place. And of course, we have a housing crisis. Who wouldn't want to live here? It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, another thing about San Francisco, too, like I totally romanticized it. Like I loved the hippie music. I loved the Grateful Dead. And like when I visited there, I was like, I want to visit Haight-Ashbury. And it's just so interesting, too, especially with the way that you're describing your background with having a lot of Eastern and Western influences of studying and having a mentor from that school that Richard Tarnas is a part of. It seems like San Francisco has like a really strong tradition, too, of integrating Eastern philosophy into the West. I mean, when you think about the 60s and when all of that stuff became more mainstream, it seems like a lot of it was happening in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, you can even taste it in the culinary scene, you know? This is why I'm so comfortable here, because I can get my Asian food, you know, which is my, you know, how I was brought up, and never suffer. You know, I enjoy the cuisine over here, but I also enjoy the San Franciscan take on all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember eating in Chinatown. That was really fun.
Yeah.
It's got, like, I think the biggest Chinatown in America. The New York one might be bigger, but yeah, I think San Francisco is the biggest. So yeah, you know, it is this interesting integration of all these Eastern cultures with the West, and it makes sense that there are people teaching feng shui and astrology coming out of San Francisco. It's very different too from where we're located in Chicago. We're kind of like the more blue collar, salt of the earth, middle America, big city. So there definitely isn't as much integration of Eastern mysticism or different religions and cultures as much as you would see in a place on the coasts like San Francisco or New York.
Right.
I'd be curious. I'm definitely going to be looking into feng shui more because I want to know what like Chicago could represent in that regard, if it's the right place for me or something like that. So that's super interesting.
Yeah.
And I think in feng shui, another thing that I found is that they have like the different elements and the goal is to kind of incorporate them into your physical space. So there's like wood and metal and like earth and water. Is that correct?
Correct. And the Chinese actually sees the elements in five as opposed to four, the great. But before you even do that, you have to look at your four pillars, and that is your, in so many ways, your basic natal chart to see if you are wood deficient or are you earth deficient, are you metal deficient, and then you sort of add that feature that you're missing in your natal chart in your environment. Does that make sense?
Oh, so it's yeah. Just, it's, that, mm-hmm. that makes
so it's kind
sense.
Of like an elemental remedy more so. And when it comes down to feng shui, there's what you are talking about. They actually call it the form school, which is actually taking a look at the embodiment and moving physical things around. But there's also what they call the compass direction, the compass school. And they look at your directions, mm-hmm. you know. And for me, it's really fascinating because, you know, in calculating our astrology, we do involve a GPS coordinates. We have those natal calculations as well. Now, of course, this is on my ongoing list of investigation in the future, but that definitely sparked questions, you know, to kind of take a look at someone's longitude, latitude, and see it from the feng shui perspective as crossing it, cross-referencing it with your natal chart.
Yeah, it reminds me of astrocartography, which you can mm-hmm. you can look up. I think I know that my moon line
uh-huh.
goes through New Orleans, which I lived in for a period of time. And I think my moon line and my Mars line intersects like north of Nashville, which I've considered oh. moving
Ooh.
To.
I would move to Nashville.
But it's weird. Like everything else is kind of undesirable places to live. Like there's, I think my... Mm-hmm. Jupiter and Venus might be near each other in like central Minnesota. So it's mm-hmm. interesting to look at it, especially like when you think about your options and maybe the ideal astrocartography places aren't where you really think you should live, but
mm-hmm. and sometimes, you know, well, when I practice feng shui, the form of astrology that I was practicing is this form of astrology that was practiced in the Tang Dynasty, 13th century Chinese court. And it's called pole star astrology. And you would look at certain houses and see when are those openings are happening when you are, you know, opening that, you know, can of worm over there, and you know you have to be over here to open up this storyline over here. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, I love how it's kind of like, you know, layered. Feng shui is like layered on top of astrology. You kind of have to start with your birth chart, and maybe mm-hmm. you know when we do astrology and we don't incorporate like a feng shui element, maybe we're like missing out a lot, because I love the idea of looking at, you know, okay, what elements am I deficient in, and transforming my space around that. And mm-hmm. I feel like it has a real potential to kind of take astrology to the next level. You know?
Yeah. I think this is, there's a reason why I called my, you know, it's not astrology school, it's mystery school. I don't want it to be bound. I want it to be able to play and explore these concepts as well.
So for someone like Dan, who is, I guess, deficient in earth and air, what would you recommend?
A leather couch in a library.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Earth is... very much something that is grounding, something that is kind of sinking, right? And like a really comfy leather couch is so earthy. And then with the element of air, you know, mental stimulation, I mean, you know, library. So to have a little nook surrounding by books with leather couch, that would be, you know, my first feng shui suggestion.
I've never thought about the I'm visualizing leather in my head, and it sounds very appropriate. I have a super comfy couch, but it's like covered in like paint stains from painting. So it's kind of like an art studio, like crash pad couch, but I do have kind of a library nook as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that idea that like you kind of have to take, you know, a bit of an approach kind of like Marie Kondo of like decluttering, or just kind of, if the objects around you are creating this better sense of flow in your daily routine, this better sense of flow of like chi, then, you know, you kind of have to make sure everything has its place. So yeah, I guess in a practical way, that's kind of, that might be the first step for people in making their place more feng shui, is just kind of like looking at what are you really using, what has its purpose, and what, you know, doesn't, and kind of moving past certain things.
The number one problem is, and the number one problem in feng shui and in life is stagnant qi. You know, this things that just piled up with no particular purpose because it hasn't been revised in a very long time.
Yeah, I connect with that. I'm always kind of like going through my stuff and like donating books that I'm not going to read and like stuff like that, you know, cleaning out my closet. Because, yeah, you just feel like, I feel like you really do feel a sense of vibrancy after you do kind of declutter something.
Especially if you have Virgo placement. This is how you relax.
Yeah, I do a lot of cleaning, so and decluttering, so that might be me.
What's your Virgo placement, Scarlett?
I can't remember. Dan did my chart a little while ago.
Well, you're in Aries rising, so that would mean 11th house, right? Or no, not 11th house, 6th house, right?
6th house, yeah, daily life.
Yeah, so I guess that makes sense.
Aries risings are easy to just picture where everything is, and it's sort of like because the signs align with the associated houses.
Yeah.
It's like you're kind of a good everything. You're a good Aries, you're a good Virgo, you're a good Libra, because it's like in alignment with the houses.
Scarlet. The 12 letters of astrology alphabet.
Yeah, exactly. I think I got a pretty good chart. I'm not, it's not super gnarly, I guess, as Dan was describing people's charts earlier.
I have a gnarly chart. My chart is really, that's like part of the reason it appeals to me so much, and maybe why I believe in it so much, is because it validates like the crazy, like conflicting nature of my personality. So.
No, really? Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of oppositions?
I basically have, I have Midheaven, Sun, Mars, and Venus pretty close together in Leo, squaring Pluto, Moon, and my ascendant in Scorpio. So, so yeah, like I have like Moon square Sun, I have ascendant square Sun, I have a, like Midheaven square Pluto, Sun square Pluto. So
that is so interesting. I think everyone that I've talked to this month have like Scorpio Leo square majorly.
Yeah, that's that. I'm majorly
that
Scorpio Leo.
Clients, and now you. It's so interesting to you know, and I have another two of my upcoming clients. Definitely have Pluto Sun square as well in Leo Scorpio. Really fascinating. Thanks, Dan.
I'm wondering what conclusions you've come to by talking with some of these people, just for my own insight.
It's very, very interesting. Because Pluto, especially, squaring the sun. If you can imagine, these are the furthest, you know, the sun is at the center. Pluto is the furthest from the center. And it is having, you know, they are having contact. And by square, it's a hard contact. So, you know, Leo wants to embrace everyone, wants to, you know, be light, literally, right? Solar. And then you have Pluto, who is the opposite. Pluto wants to be in the shadow.
Yep.
Pluto is, you know, have an aversion to light. So in so many ways, you have this polarity always in play. And in a square dynamic, this causing, you know, the journey is to reconcile this internal square between these two forces. You know, Pluto is covert. Sun wants to be known. So it's very interesting that you have a podcast because, you know, from that square, it's potentially is, you know, the high side and the low side of it at its maximum range, you know, the love and hate relationship with it.
Yeah, the podcast definitely brings out my Leo nature. And I'm also like a artist and musician. And my problem is I take on way too many creative endeavors. But my Scorpio Pluto nature doesn't want to share, doesn't want to be seen, and kind of hates narcissism. But but once I'm on the stage, it's like... I feel totally at home and I feel like a rush. But then when I go home to like do the work, I'm like, oh, you're horrible. This is terrible. And and most, I mean, I think to sort of choose the life style that I've chosen, which is sort of like all over the place and doing too many different creative things at once. To choose that lifestyle, you have to be kind of nuts and you have to have sort of like a wound or a
gnarly chart, perhaps.
A gnarly chart that like drives you towards it.
Are you in your Gemini perfection?
Yeah, I am.
Oh my God.
I'm about to leave it and enter a moon, ninth house moon perfection in like a week and a half. Thank God.
Well, I think from Gemini to Moon, it'll calm down a little bit, you know? I mean, you know, to have a Gemini perfection in the cycle, this is as stretched thin as you're going to get. And then it's going to calm down, right? I don't know. What's your feel on that?
Well, yeah, I'm in a Gemini perfection. And it's this year that we started the podcast. And I'm all...
And for our listeners, you should explain what that is for people who aren't
aware. Oh, right.
Yeah, perfections are basically a system where you based on your birthday and your age, you kick off a new yearly cycle that is ruled by a house and a house ruler. So I'm 31 because I'm a Scorpio rising. By the time you loop around every age, you know, like at age 0 to 1, you're in a first house perfection. Age 1 to 2, you're in a second house and so forth. And you keep going around and around. So you're 30, Scarlett. So you're in a seventh house perfection year and you're a Libra seventh house. So you're in a Venus perfection year.
Oh, that's perfect for me.
Yeah.
I'm doing good.
Yeah.
I feel good about it.
But then next year you enter. Venus? Eighth house, which sucks. I'm in retrospect looking at my like eighth house year and I'm like, this wasn't the best year, to be totally honest. I mean, it wasn't that great, you know,
but it's probably one of the time that you dig deeper into the occult and use that in practice.
Hence this show.
You know, what the eighth house is about. It's not meant to be extroverted. It's meant to be introverted and, you know, is the, and play with the mystery in life.
Yeah, I definitely have.
I don't know. I like water houses. I don't mind it at all.
Yeah.
So what are some of the more challenging aspects of your chart? Would you say, like, do you consider yourself as having a difficult chart, like Dan thinks of his?
Well, I have what they call the T square, and it is a formation. And I know that for someone like me, who basically practice a lot more ancient astrology, however. Tied in modern astrology as well. And again, with my background, I always look at it as an archetype, you know, an an archetype within the collective subconscious, having this unique experience to, you know. And for me, in my personal natal chart, I think I'm very much Mercury dominant. Mm-hmm. I have my ascendant in Virgo. I have Sun Mercury in conjunction in Virgo. Venus conjunct ascendant, squaring, of course, my midheaven in Gemini, another Mercury ruled sign. In my third house, I have Pluto and Saturn. So basically, is this a very mercurial life, you know, communicate. And that's what I really enjoy, actually. I enjoy writing. Now, I enjoy this, conversations. I love symbolisms and decoding it, and of course, astrology. And, you know, I contemplate a lot on archetypes of Mercury, which is Hermes, the winged messengers of the gods, and, you know, this basically a hermaphrodite, you know, bisexual as well, because this is the interconnector of duality, the, you know, inside world and outer world, the, you know, the feminine and the masculine, anything that you can categorize in duality, Mercury and or Hermes is the agent for it to have a conversation. So I like that in my chart.
Yeah, is that in a way like thinking about Mercury or Hermes kind of similar to like yin yang and like how that's connected is kind of that union, or is it different? Like,
so very much so. In my videos recently, I did a series, and I talked about basically the upward triangle. It is the trilogy of the masculine. This is the patriarch, and that's symbolized by the three masculine planets that we have in the seven traditional planets. You have the sun, of course, is a masculine force. And then you have Jupiter, and then you have Mars, right? So these creates the upward triangle. And then you have the downward triangle, Venus, Moon, of course, and Saturn is, for me, is a feminine planet. So you have these two triangles at play, the upward and the downward. And Mercury is the one, the binding agent of this three masculine and the three feminine. You need one, the communicator. And this is why Mercury rules connection. Because without Mercury, without communication, how can a yin yang have a conversation? How can masculine and feminine have a conversation?
Yeah, I think more and more I'm thinking of the moon and Mercury as like underrated in their importance in astrology, because they move so quickly, and like every time any planet interacts with Mercury, it's like all the planets are up in the zodiac doing their thing, and Mercury is like connecting one to the other. Or it's like every time Mercury interacts with the planet, it's almost sending the message like, hey, Jupiter in Sag, Saturn in Capricorn over here just did this. You better know this is going on. So it's sort of like, I feel like Mercury really is a messenger in that sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is why I have my own entity. So the way I roll things out, the way I teach, I begin with Mercury. I do not start with the luminaries. I started with Mercury first. And then, because if you're familiar with astrology symbols, Mercury is the only one glyph within the seven that has all three, which is the half crescent, the moon, the sun, the full circle, and then the axis of time and space, the cross. And so I always start with Mercury. And then I start by introducing the luminaries, the sun and the moon, in contrast to one another. Because I felt like in the past, whenever I explain sun and moon separately, they get mixed up. And the way that I feel our human mind works best is through contrast. And then I always teach Mars and Venus, again, in contrast to one another. And then Saturn and Jupiter, because I always feel Saturn and Jupiter is this pair that is very much like the sun and the moon. You know, for me, you know, Saturn is the iron fist, but Jupiter is the velvet glove. This is the way I explain Saturn and Jupiter and how they're a pair in that way.
And you put Saturn as kind of one of the three feminine planets. Is that traditional, or do you have a reason why you chose Saturn for that third feminine?
Well, I studied Thema Mundi. I studied, you know, ancient astrology, predominantly from Demetra George and also Chris Brennan. I'm a Hellenistic astrology as well, and of course I also studied so many other schools, right? Like the EA school of things, which is evolutionary astrology. But in the end, I always go back to the first seven. And one day, while I was just pretty much digesting everything, point, and I kind of have to make a decision, one day I just start drawing the glyph, you know, and I see how the glyph, when you take the Mercury in the center, then everything just falls into its place. So when I pretty much draw the glyph of Jupiter as a masculine, then Saturn is like the only last piece of the puzzle that needs to fit in that allocation of the feminine Earth. And of course, here Saturn rules Capricorn, which is, you know, a feminine and an Earth. These are, you know, very yin symbolism here that we're talking about. And Saturn also, I know it's controversial because Father of Time and everything, but Saturn always talks about structure, and structure always talks about matter, and matter is manifested in yin forces. So for me, definitely a yin Earth.
Yeah, I kind of think it's interesting too, when you think about like Saturn being traditionally like Father Time masculine, but when you think about like the god of time, to me, time kind of, it has this like feminine component, because like, you know, in culture, like women give birth. So like women are responsible for continuing the timeline in a way. So
absolutely.
There's kind of this interesting thing about time in general that I think could be considered from like a feminine kind of perspective.
Well, I don't even remember where I heard this, but I've heard the concept that all esoteric and like mathematical knowledge was first discovered by women because of the cycle, their cycles and the lunar cycles being in connection. Like women were the first to sort of conceptualize the passage of time, and also like mathematics in a way. So,
well, yeah, for birth, you'd have to do that too. You'd have to, like, you know, you'd probably be timing out like when, trying to guess when your birth would be or when you'd be having birth. Having a baby. Yeah, so I think that makes sense.
I mean, of course, the thing that what women has is that we are a living cycle of creations. Within the 28 days, we are, it's a possibility for a life to take place every time. So in so many ways, this cycle of 28 days, it is so old, it is untraceable by history, but yet so captured in astrology, right? the cycle of the moon. It's just been always. Always.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting, when I talk to people who are like complete skeptics, like think all of this is BS, and I talk to other women, and sometimes I just ask them, like, you know, did you ever question why the female cycle is 28 days, which is the same as the moon? And then for some reason, it just kind of like makes them go, oh, I guess I never thought about that. Maybe there is some kind of interesting connection, because people don't think about it who aren't, you know, into this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's part of my mission, is to actually see all these symbolisms are so obvious. So obvious, we still live it. I mean, there's a reason beyond the 28 days that women experience. I don't know a single person that have been able to opt out of the 7 days ritual that somehow collectively we agree upon. And that is so well set in the Thema Mundi, with the sun as Sunday and moon. You know, you hear it in another language, Lundi, Lunadi, the day of Luna, the moon. Mardi, Tuesday, the day of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday, Mercury, Mercurio, that's Wednesday. You have Jupiter, Thor, Thursday. And of course, Venus, Friday, the Friar Day. Saturn, the most outer realm from the naked eyes, is Saturday. And this is why we have Sabbath on Saturday, Sabato. I mean, we do all these ritualistic thing. And in the eye of astrology, we are time. And the planetary systems and its movement that is inherently predictive, it is the fabric of our time. So, I mean, why wouldn't you want to look at that, you know? It's so fascinating.
I feel like it's so helpful in giving you the tools to tell a story, because it's like you're learning the archetypes, and you need archetypes to tell a good story or a good myth. And it brings me back mm-hmm. to when I was studying Joseph Campbell, and for the purposes of being a fiction writer. And I kind of have backed away from that in a way, but I feel like after all this astrology education, it is equipping you to either write literal fiction, or just when you're talking to somebody about their problems in a session, you're sort of crafting their story and their trials and tribulations. So I'm thinking about this a lot too, with Mercury being retrograde, me going through my old journals and like crafting my timeline. It's like, oh damn, like, I was really reading through my Saturn return stuff, and I had my Saturn return.
How was it for you?
I had it in Sagittarius. So I remember you mentioned Chris Brennan.
Yeah.
I discovered his show when they did the episode of Saturn entering Sagittarius. And that was
Oh, I remember that episode. I think it was also with Patrick Watson, right?
I can't. It could be. I just remember I was like, wait, what's a Saturn return? Oh, I'm in my Saturn return. And I always thought of my Saturn return starting when they did that episode, which is when it made the ingress in the fall of 2015. But really, it made the ingress in December of 2014 and was there for the beginning of 2015, then retrograded back in June of into Scorpio in June of 2015. So I always conceptualize my Saturn return as beginning in the fall of 2015. But really, the first time it really started at the very end of 2014, I was reading my journals and literally just with no knowledge of this, being like, I really am getting hit so hard, and the only thing I can do is just grow up and be an adult. This is like my final straw. And it's like, damn, that was like, that was very Saturnine.
So Saturnian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is, yeah, the diary of someone who is thick in their Saturn return. But you know what comes after Saturn return, though? Saturn trine, right? Somewhere along the way, it will do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that'll be, or Saturn trine your natal Saturn, or is it?
No, well, I mean, sorry, I guess I was just talking about my chart there. Because I had Saturn return and then I had Saturn trine. So in that period of life, I definitely have, fixed my relationship with Saturn archetypally as well. Liz Green with, Saturn, the new look at the old devil. And then definitely really looking at Saturn as a teacher instead of Satan,
Yeah. Well, you said you have Saturn and Pluto. Are you Pluto and Saturn in Scorpio?
Yes, my Pluto is very prominent in Scorpio.
That's got it. Because I've heard
0 degree, 1 minute.
We were talking to another guest about how Saturn in Scorpio was really hard for people having their Saturn returns with those themes, and especially with mm-hmm. Pluto being there. So, and you said that you kind of discovered astrology around that time, right?
Well, I lost my mother. So that was harsh, right? That's Pluto, Saturn right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, I became interested to the study of just existence, consciousness. And that led me to the study of cosmology, which is the study of the totality of the whole thing. And then within cosmology, then you realize, oh, there's Western cosmology. How do the Western think about life? The Eastern cosmology, how does the Eastern think about life? So yeah, that was definitely a Saturnian time for me as well, because at the same time, that co-presence in that same house. So for example, when my mom passed away, that's when also I start seeking therapy. And the co-presence is that while I'm doing therapy at the same time, I'm studying esoteric knowledge, because my therapist, like I said, from CIIS, and she kind of gave breadcrumbs in my healing process that now led me to this path. So a little shout out there for Sarah Feely. I miss her. So she's definitely was a huge influence, because I was also participating in my own healing, Pluto and Scorpio really absorb in that transformation as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting towards the end here, Nisa. It was such a fun chat. We covered a lot of ground. For our listeners, where can they find you and where can they get in contact with you?
Oh, thank you so much. So I think my biggest mission is bringing the language of ancient knowledge, such astrology, out of obscurity. And I have a weekly show on YouTube, and my channel is VNS. That is V as in Via, and NS stands for my name, Nisa, Mystery School. And also I hang out a lot on Instagram. And my handler's name is VNS Mystery School. And I post almost every day. I also have my videos up there. And pretty much, yeah, it's kind of journal at the end of the day. It's really interesting how I have that relationship now with Instagram. It's kind of the last thing that I wrote in a day. And I share it with the world. Very 12th house, actually. Anyways.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. So for our listeners, definitely check her out on Instagram and YouTube and on her website for the VNS Mystery School as well. So yeah, thanks again for talking with us. I feel like I got a crash course on like feng shui and all these other topics. So I'm definitely going to be digging deeper into some of this stuff because it's all so fascinating. So thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you so much for your interest. I will definitely, I'm going to unpeel all of these materials some more in my my current content as well. So thank you for inspiring me.
Great. Awesome. Well, take care, Nisa.
Bye. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Dan and Scarlett.
Thank you.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for our free version of the show. If you would like the extension with our awesome continued conversation with Nisa, check out patreon.com/cosmickeys. At the $5 tier, you will get our episode extensions. So that means more content from Scarlett and I during our Cosmic Keys chats. So thanks again to Nisa for being on our show. And thanks again to our current patrons. We want to give a special thank you to Andy, Patsy, Philip, and Willie. Thanks again, guys, for being a part of our show and helping us move it forward. Scarlett and I have been doing some planning. We've got big goals for the future of the show.
And, oh, yeah. Big goals. Big dreams.
And don't forget to give us a review on iTunes. I hate to beg, but it seriously helps us. And it doesn't have to be long. It just has to be 5 stars with some words.
Yeah, that'll definitely help us out. So thank you guys again so much for listening.
Take care.